The following podcast is brought to you by the Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Good morning. Here we are together on this bright, clear winter, heart of winter morning. And we're here together to receive the Dharma, such as it is. My name is Yuka. I'm a senior student here. And today I want to talk about you. If I asked you now, if we were chatting and I said, "How are you?" What would you say? What do you feel? What is it like to be you right now? One of the things, one of the reasons I'm here, one of the things I love about this community, this Village Zendo, is that I see that the more that people practice, the more they become who they are, become themselves. The teachers have distinct personalities, so no one is trying to be Roshi or Joshin or Bernie Tetsugen Glassman Roshi. And when I present koans, I never get past if I'm aiming for the right answer. It really only works if I actually bring myself to it. And yet, as Ryotan Sensei loves to say to me, it takes a lot of practice for Yuka to be Yuka, for you to be you. Well, what is this practice? I mean, what could really possibly get in the way of you being you? Or me being me? Well, maybe it's me who gets in my way. Or maybe it's actually you. So last weekend, Muke led a discussion with two black Zen teachers, James Lynch and Malik Hokyu Walker, about the matter of Zen through the eyes of color. And so they talked about what it was like being the only people of color in many of our communities. And so I asked them, well, how did that complicate them being them? And one part of the answer was familiar. So James talked about the importance of taking care of yourself, of not defining yourself by how others see you. Very important. And that's like our practice of being awake. And then Hokyu talked about the difference between that, between being, breathing, being, and the process of objectification. So in our relationships, in our culture, we always encounter representations of ourselves. They're reflected to us, or maybe we project them. So Tokyu kept saying, not Tokyu, Hokyu kept saying that it's hard to tell which is which. Is it what you're seeing in me, or what I see in what I put on you about me? And Muke talked about what it's like when someone gives you that look, and you read their expectations into that look of fear or maybe surprise that you have status. So how do you react then? Is that also you? When you don't have models, or if your models are constrained by the culture, how do you know how to be what you are? So recently I read little bits of an essay by Ursula Le Guin in which she claimed to be a man. Not a proper man, but an imitation man, because she was born before women were invented in 1926. So only he pronouns were used to describe all of humanity. And, you know, these terse Hemingway sentences were much admired, and not so much the complex compound sentences that had semicolons. So my parents were Russian immigrants. My father loved this country because he felt accepted here, so he joined the ROTC so he could finish college, and then he wanted to serve our country. And by the way, they are heartbroken about the divisions that we're experiencing now. So we moved every year or two along with him from army base to army base. And we were the only Russians in those communities. And it was during the Cold War, and so we were misunderstood. Our religion was different, our food was different, didn't match. And then I had another problem, was that I had juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. And no one else had that. I did see kids with more obvious disabilities, and I heard them mocked in the playground, so I really didn't want to be that. I made sure that I pretended I was not that, until it became really shamingly obvious and I was banished to the choir with all the other kids who would not be picked for the teams. And that was middle school. So I was a nerd. But then we moved. And one of the great things about moving is that you can start over. You can really make a new person every time you go to a new community. And so when I started high school, I discovered drama club, and I discovered something like a superpower, which was that if I looked around to see, like, what do popular people do, I could start doing those things. So I became my construct of the preferred person. And it worked. And I thought I belonged. But now I think that this kind of superpower initiated a pretty deep split between who I feel myself to be and who I may appear to be. What do you do if you don't see yourself in others? Or if your experience of yourself feels so different from what other people feel? Well, one option, I think, is to become a hermit. So during this ango, this intensive practice period, we're studying an 18th century Zen dropout named Ryokan. Where is Ryokan? Ryokan lives today in many ways. So many have talked about his almost saintly dedication to poverty, his kindness to children, even to fleas. He was really funny. He was irreverent to the bone. And he also expressed aloneness in poetry. And I've noticed that he was often up at night. So here's just some phrases from his poems. Unable to sleep on a clear night, I toss in bed, chanting this poem. I stay awake with my pillow high until dawn. Looking at the moon, I hum all night. For no particular reason, my heart is stirred, unable to sleep, knowing that tomorrow is the beginning of the year. Won't you sing? I will get up and dance. How can I sleep with the timeless moon this evening? Okay, well, I don't know if any of you have ever had insomnia, but when I can't sleep, I feel very alone. In fact, I think for me it has maybe this dynamic purpose that in the middle of the night, there is no one to reflect me, no one to see me, no one to construct for. And so I have a place to turn around. Many of the Koans in the commentary, they talk about this place to turn around, be with myself. And I think this is especially important if you are hooked on reflections. And even more especially when those human mirrors show you something that doesn't feel true. It's a deep and quiet place. Here's Ryokan. In the evening of 1,000 peaks, I close my eyes. Among humans, myriad thoughts are trivial. Serenely, I sit on the mat. In solitude, I face an open window. The incense has burned out, and a dark night is long. Dew is thick, my robe is thin. Emerging from samadhi, I walk in the garden. The moon has risen over the highest peak. But it doesn't end there, because the sun rises then, and humans frolic, they work, they shop. So as a psychologist, I wonder why exactly he was okay with kids, but he couldn't belong in the monastery. Was it, as we've said, but was it entirely a matter of principle during a time when Zen was really missing the point? Or was it maybe just a little bit of a personality disorder? Maybe he couldn't stay put and protest. Maybe he couldn't stay in relationship, stay and be who he was. So was he a hero, not like us? Or was he a man who was struggling, too? He says, this is so cool, I get to take a sip of tea. It's not that I avoid mixing with the world, but I do better playing alone. He often writes about how his sleeves are wet from tears. Well, did the monastery have trouble accommodating this sensitive man with this very serious insomnia? Maybe he just couldn't manage that morning bell. In another poem that breaks my heart, he says, "Were there someone in the world who feels as I feel, we would talk all night in this grass hut." Well, many of the old Zen stories, the koans, appear to privilege sitting facing a wall in a cave, in a hut on a mountain. But they really kind of don't leave it at that. There's usually a twist, like a monk asked his teacher, "What's the extraordinary affair?" The teacher says, "Sitting alone on Tashuang Mountain." The monk bows. The teacher hits him. "What?" So, you know, there are a lot of koans that involve someone being whacked even when what they said or did seemed to be the right thing. And, you know, especially because nowadays we don't go around really hitting each other. Anyways, Zen teachers won't do it unless you ask them to. I understand these hits as a way that life wakes you up. The way that no preparation, no understanding takes away the pain of a sudden change. You're fine, you get sick, bam. Someone you love gets injured. Someone leaves you, bam. You're an accomplished Zen teacher maybe, but if you're black today, someone treats you like a criminal, bam. Trying to make my bam soft because people who listen on the podcast, more pain than you have to deal with. So, you know, who are you when life smacks you around like that and you can't be who you want to believe you are? So here's another story from the Blue Cliff Record also. And the title is Elder Ting Stands Motionless. And I'm going to paraphrase the koan. So Elder Ting was studying with Lin Chi, and Ting asked his teacher, what is the great meaning of the Buddhist teaching? Well, so Chi, so imagine this, Chi actually gets down off the meditation seat, he grabs Ting, he slaps him, and then pushes him away. And Ting, shocked, I think, just stands there. And another monk standing by says, Elder Ting, why don't you bow? So he does. And ha-ha, he's enlightened. So what was the factor that enlightened Elder Ting? So, you know, the title, some of the commentaries feature the purity of standing still as if the blow couldn't shake this great adept. But I am really interested in that monk standing by. Joshin says that he was probably the Jisha. And so Ting asks about the meaning. He gets well slapped by life. And then the helpful Jisha says, hey, you know, you can bow. Sui Tu, who's one of the people who comments, says this about the Jisha. On neutral ground, there is a man who can see through it all. He has completely attained the other's power. When someone dies in the Eastern house, the people of the Western house help them mourn. The people of the Western house help them mourn. So life does what it does. Bam, there's a sudden change, a surprise. We stand still. A good neutral friend says, bow, accept this too. And then, well, our community can witness, can encourage, can frame the experience. Help us to mourn, help us to be with anger. So, if I am misperceived, or if I'm not perceived. So as a white, older woman now, it's more how I react to being invisible. So people's eyes glide right over me on the way to someone else. And maybe I looked at the face and I hoped for a connection. And it didn't come. And so I feel that little kind of indent, that hurt. And the thoughts come, well, I don't matter. Do I even exist if I'm not seen? And then, oh, I really shouldn't think like that. It's so freeing not to be seen. What's wrong with my practice that I can't just let this stuff roll off of me? And what the hell? And then anger. This culture is so fucked up. I'm going to make a peace about it. But then despair. What if no one comes? Why don't you bow? Or maybe even, I see you. Let me bow with you. Or you might talk to a teacher and hear, yes, that is the answer to the koan. Right there. Roshi talked the other day on Thursday about othering, about making someone a stranger or an enemy because their characteristics are different, like if their gender or their ability or their skin color doesn't fit the custom. And I think we do that to ourselves when we believe our self-image over our experience. The self-image could be projection or reflection or an aspiration. But then there's what we actually feel. Were there someone in the world who feels as I feel, we could talk all night in this grass hut. Who feels as I feel, not who thinks as I think, or looks as I look, or loves as I love, and on and on. Who feels as I feel. And maybe it's stretching it a bit, but maybe if we consider the circumstances, everyone feels as I feel. At least that's what we believe in acting class. You just let the circumstances pour through you, and then you'll feel as you feel. When we sit on the cushion, we practice experiencing this moment by moment. And every now and then, we forget the self construction. And we become breathing, or we become walking or bowing. But what about talking or working? Would it be possible to let yourself pour through yourself without interference, including everything? If we change the context of that Jisha's advice to our times now, if we say, instead of why don't you bow, why don't you speak from the heart? What if Trump were able to say, what if our president were able to say, I feel so afraid that I'll lose the things that I think give me value, give me worth? What if we were able to speak from our experience about our constructions instead of talking from our constructions? I'll leave you with this final poem from Ryokan. The persimmon picker's testicles look frozen in the autumn wind.